This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. The federal government and Texas are engaged in a showdown over the southern border. The Justice Department has filed a lawsuit after the state refused to remove large buoys in the Rio Grande in an effort to block migrants from crossing the border. CBS's Janet Chamlian in Texas.
They stretch only 1,000 feet along the state's 1,200-mile border. Anchored to the river bottom, the buoys roll if someone tries to climb over them. Along with newly erected razor fencing along the shoreline, it's part of a multi-billion dollar state effort to deter illegal immigration.
We're securing the border at the border. What these buoys will allow us to do is to prevent people from even getting to the border.
But migrants have reportedly become tangled in the wire and suffered injuries.
U.S. Border Patrol is warning people not to cross the border illegally into the desert and mountains of West Texas due to the heat wave. The Weather Channel meteorologist Jackie Jarrus with what may be some welcome news for those dealing with extreme heat.
As for the southwest, yes, we're going to still stay hot there, but the worst of the heat likely peaking. But this already, the hottest July on record with an average temperature over 102.
The heat will expand this week into the Midwest and Northeast. Scorching temperatures have engulfed Europe, fueling dozens of massive wildfires in Greece and displacing more than 30,000 people. CBS's Chris Lipsay.
Europe is now heating faster than any other continent amid climate change. But fewer than 10% of European households have air conditioners, compared to 90% in the U.S.
Members of the Israeli parliament approve a major part of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's controversial judicial reform plan, triggering more mass protests. Correspondent Robert Berger with that.
The Supreme Court would be able to come to the government and say that a certain decision is unreasonable under previous laws, but under this new law, it wouldn't be able to do so. And so critics say basically the government can do whatever it wants without any checks and balances.
Still a lot of questions about the U.S. Army private, Travis King, since he ran into North Korea last week. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller.
We have made outreach to North Korea to let them know that we wanted to ascertain the whereabouts of Private King. We wanted information about his safety, but we have not received any response from them at all.
An investigation has been launched into why an Ohio officer early this month allowed his police dog to attack a truck driver and while state highway patrol troopers were urging the officer to hold the dog back. After a lengthy pursuit over a missing truck mud flap, body camera footage shows Jadarius Rose, who was black, eventually getting out of his truck and on his knees with his hands raised in the air. Then the dog was deployed and attacked him. He was taken to a hospital bleeding, but was later jailed for 3 days before being released. This is CBS News.
Find great hires fast with Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring solution makes it easy to attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Imagine.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
For 105.7 CFW and the Tap FM 93.5, I'm Jimmy Cuska. Here's what you need to know in the Chippewa Valley. A teenage boy is in custody after leading a sheriff's deputy on a high-speed chase on Eau Claire's north side yesterday afternoon. The Eau Claire County Sheriff's Office said they tried to stop a vehicle for signs of drunk driving as it was swerving between lanes on the north crossing. The driver of the vehicle sped away, getting up to speeds of 100 miles per hour before crashing in a roundabout, rolling the vehicle over. The only person hurt in the crash was a 17-year-old driver who was being referred for charges of OWI, fleeing an officer, and recklessly endangering safety. The National Weather Service says temperatures this week will be well into the 80s, with many places into the 90s as a heat wave settles in. Thursday is expected to be the hottest day in the area. Today, most places will stay in the 80s. In addition, our entire listening area is in an air quality advisory due to Canadian wildfire smoke through noon tomorrow. From the Civic Media News Desk here in Western Wisconsin, I'm Jimmy Cuska.
It's so hot. Wait. Now it's going to rain? It is summer in Wisconsin.
As much as we love it, we love to hate it too. Find a forecast you can count on along with the in-depth details you need, only from the Civic Media Weather Team.
These extended conditions have led us into a flash drought. Sitting in these above average temperatures with minimal rain has swiftly altered the local climate.
Your weather and more for your part of Wisconsin.
On your local Civic Media radio station and streaming on the Civic Media app.
This time of year, the world's busiest airport is Oshkosh.
Josh during the Experimental Aircraft Association EAA Air Venture. 10,000 airplanes fly in, typically 600,000 people visit, spending $170 million. Big numbers worth celebrating considering EAA started in a Milwaukee basement with a little more than 100 people 70 years ago. EAA runs through July 30th. Keep an eye to the sky if you're in the Oshkosh area. Daily air shows start at 2:30. I'm Terry Barr.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
I have Corrine Hendrickson, part of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Action Needed group.
We spend $500 on our infants and toddlers on average. If you go to the other countries, you're talking about $11,000 on average in Europe and the other developed countries. It makes a difference. They end up spending less on their K-12 system. They end up spending less on their colleges. They end up spending less on jail.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Weekday mornings 6 till 8.
On your local civic media radio station and on the app. Pursuing the truth wherever it may lead. The Todd Albaugh Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3. Join the conversation. Get involved. The Todd Albaugh Show on your local civic media radio station and on the app.
Telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Georgia on my mind. And, you know, for all the talk of Fannie Willis and they're going to go get Trump, the story about the next fixed election kind of coming into frame as the Georgia Secretary of State has announced a new purging. A new cleansing, I think the word is that they're using. We're going to cleanse some 200,000 people off the voter rolls. And gee, I wonder who those people could be. And here to share some thoughts on who that could be and, well, where we're going, I've asked our good friend Greg Palast to come talk with us. Greg is an investigative journalist, New York Times best-selling author, and the director of Vigilante, Georgia's vote suppression hitman. You can find all of that stuff at gregpalast.com. Greg, thanks for taking time for us.
Glad to be with you again, Rick.
So here we are again. More purges, more kicking people off the rolls, more gimmicks.
Yeah, okay, here's what's going on. And I'm getting sick and tired of the lamestream media praising Brian Kemp, the GOP uber right-wing governor of Georgia, and his uber right-wing secretary of state. They hate Trump. It's an internal battle, but that doesn't make them heroes, because Trump attacked them for not fixing the election good enough for him. They really tried. Take my word for it. They really tried. So what the latest thing is that the state of Georgia, the Republican Secretary of State, much praised on 60 Minutes, has just announced the removal of another 191,000 voters from the voter rolls. Now, this is the guy who told 60 Minutes, who told the United States Congress, he didn't find a single provable case of an illegal voter voting in Georgia, not one. Yet he's removing 191,000 voters. Now, if these voters are illegal voters, yeah, they should go. But how did he find 191,000 illegal voters, yet not one of them had voted? The answer is, yes, he says he has the cleanest voter rolls in America. Yes, he's bleached them whiter than white. We have to go back to my investigation, which I did for the ACLU and for Leonardo DiCaprio and his website. So the ACLU issued my report that when last time they did this purge of 198,000 voters, 300,000 voters, we found that 198,000 of them were all legal voters. Let me give you an example. In 2018, the same characters, well, that was Brian Kemp himself as Secretary of State before he became governor, removed 340,000 voters. In fact, exactly 340,144 voters who were legal voters. Those are statistics. Okay, let me give you the faces and names. Christine Jordan, 92 years old. I was there at the polling station when she was thrown out of the polling station. She had her walker. By the way, it was storming outside. She's thrown back out in the storm saying, you can't vote here at this polling station. It was going to be her 50th year of voting at that polling station in Atlanta. Christine Jordan, by the way, the first year she voted was 1968, which was the year her cousin, Martin Luther King, was assassinated. So they literally removed Martin Luther King's 92-year-old cousin from the voter rolls, saying she didn't live in Atlanta anymore at her address. Well, I decided, you know, hey, she might be Martin Luther King's cousin. She might be 92, but she could be a scammer. So she agreed for me to go to her house, and there was her house right there near the polling station. And in addition, to prove that she'd been there the 50 years, there were pictures on the wall with her and her cousin King at the dining room table over the decades. So these are the people they are removing.
And how are they doing this? And what's the justification?
The justification is that for example, they sent them a notice. What they do is, I'll give you another great example. They send out notices and they say, oh, someone challenges and says they don't live in Georgia anymore or at that address because they sent them a letter. It got bounced. In the case of Christine Jordan, she had her mail forwarded to her granddaughter down the street, still in the district. And they said, well, she's not living at that address because her mail was forwarded. Your mailing address is not it. The post office actually keeps address of convenience forwarding. How did I know 340,144 voters were illegally removed? We got the top experts in the nation working with the post office and using computers, obviously. We went through every single name and found out these people live where they live. Or they'll do something, they'll drive by and they'll say, oh, that looks empty, and they'll stop that. Or they'll send them a notice, here's where your polling station is, and the post office will screw up and send it back non-deliverable. Well, guess what? If you stay within your county, you move within your county, you don't have to re-register, you don't lose your vote. Who moves constantly? According to the U.S. Census, it's about 3-1 poor people to wealthier people. And the people that are most itinerant are called students. Some of us call them Democrats. I had one student, the same scam in Wisconsin, who had moved in, you know, he's moved his dorm room from one room to another in the same building. They took away his right to vote. He said he didn't live at his voting address. Yeah, he did. This is the game. And we looked through the racial profile. Well, look, the demographic profile was obvious. And that's why Stacey Abrams won the election in 2018. And they denied it to her. And now they want to make sure that in 2024, presidential candidate Brian Kemp wins Georgia.
So are you saying that they're rigging elections? Is that what you're saying? Because I get all my conservative friends, they think that the elections are rigged. Is this what you're telling me?
Yeah, but you know, when Trump used to say the election's rigged, as I wrote in my book, How Trump Stole 2020, good close prediction. Yeah, of course he said that they're rigged because he's rigging them with his friends. By the way, if you want to see him say that, the film The Best Democracy Money Can Buy is free for download, available at gregpalast.com. So you can see Trump say it himself and our response in detail, which takes a couple of fun hours. But the truth is, it's been a massive, massive vote suppression game. And what's really bugging me, I was talking with a journalism professor last night, and he and I were furious together about something, which is the New York Times is always in the mainstream media, always running stories about how elections, that there's massive racial vote suppression, massive suppression of the student vote, basically Democratic votes. But they have never, ever, ever reported, by the way, that vote suppression cost these elections. Stacey Abrams, Al Gore, 358 votes. There's all this vote suppression, but hey, it didn't make a difference. So they will never actually say an election's been stolen. Well, I'll say it. But the thing is, and now they're using, the problem is that they're using, like I heard my good friend, Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky say, we have to have more censorship of the internet so that we don't allow people to say elections have been stolen. Well, Jan, I'm one of your close friends. I've said it was stolen. You repeated my words back in 2000. We just have to stop. When it's not the issue of whether elections are stolen, it's who and how. I was in with the Justice Department. We didn't say, oh, a crime was committed. We looked for the perpetrators and looked for their methods and put them in prison. So right. It's the people who did it.
Well, I think the difference is, you know, when people think that the election was stolen, that there are some nefarious folks in, working in dark shadows, you know, taking thumb drives or driving around ballots or doing all kinds of things under the cloak of darkness. Whereas what Republicans have done election cycle after election cycle is just use the mechanisms of government to move the laws in a way that allow them just to throw people off and don't let them participate.
Well, in fact, we sued the NAACP, Black Voters Matter Fund, and I was an expert witness in the case, sued in federal court the last time they removed 198,000 people, and based on my ACLU investigation. And, you know, the problem we run into is the courts say, oh, it's too late to allow these people to vote, to correct the voter rolls. Yeah. It's too late to correct the voter rolls. Then when you sue in advance, they say it's too early. It's very hard with the courts we have now.
Because they're all those two are decidedly in the pocket of the wealth class. And again, you wonder why they want to purge Democratic votes, why they want to stop Democratic votes from happening, because, well, the wealth class probably couldn't exist without doing that.
You wonder why the
decider of government who decides who gets what, and why the wealth class always gets what they need and working people always get screwed. You wonder how that plays out. And this is a huge part of it.
Well, as I've always said, vote suppression is class war by other means. And most of my work shows the massive racial disparity. But, you know, race is kind of the mark of lower income in America. But when you really look, when I'm a statistician and an economist by training, when I look, do deep dives into these statistics, the reason it looks racial is that it's class. We go after low income people on get them off the voter rolls. You'll see this, like the group that's most under attack are the American native voters from the Pueblos and the tribes in the West. Like, for example, I was just at the Osage Reservation. They were talking about how they had to do an emergency voter registration education drive in Arizona, because Arizona literally removed polling stations from reservations. I don't mean that they reduced the number of stations. There were reservations where they completely eliminated polling stations. By the way, in case you're wondering, indigenous people of America are solid Democrats. Now, you're shocked, I know that, but they're also not the wealthiest people in America. I know some people say, oh, casino Americans, but you go to the Pueblos and I don't see a lot of riches out there, okay? So it is class war by other means. And they go after students. They go after, and I've seen low-income areas in New Mexico where the machines didn't register a single vote for president of the United States. How about that? I mean, and now this is not, by the way, this is not about Trump's thing with Dominion and all that. They're going to cymatic that they're some guy like Lex Luthor and Stacey Abrams and
it's not even conspiratorial. I don't think, Greg.
I just want to get rid of the idea that there's someone in a cave messing with the software. In 20 some years of this business, I've never seen a software change affect an election at all, ever. But what you do see is machines shut down. It's real simple. In Florida, we saw 28,000 votes disappear simply because they lost the chips from certain precincts. They don't have to know how you vote to mess with you, because people vote like their neighbors. If you are in a low income African American area in Tampa, it pretty much, if you eliminate that precinct by a glitch, again, they're not messing with the software. It's not complicated stuff. It literally gets glitched.
Or just an old machine that broke down.
Yeah, they give the crap, you know, it's statistics. Yeah. They give the crap machines into low-income areas, just like they give crap hospitals, crap schools, crap police. You get the crap voting machines. You know, there's no magic to this. There's no great conspiracy. It's pretty simple, crude stuff. But I have to say, I've got my Swiss in-laws here, and they're like, they can't believe this is how America, the land of democracy, operates.
Yeah, you listen to the Rick Smith Show with Greg Palast, investigative journalist, New York Times best-selling author, and the director of Vigilante, Georgia's Vote Suppression Hitman, a must-see. You can find all that stuff at gregpalast.com. I want to get to that movie, though, because all of this stuff is in that movie of yours. All of this shouldn't be a shock to anyone. We've talked about this before. In October and November last year, we did a number of events around the country, you know, showing your movie. They're right out in front doing this stuff. There's no cloak and dagger. There's no smoke filled room. They're just out in front doing it.
Well, I have to say, by the way, you can't get Vigilante right now, because here's the exclusive breaking story for Rick Smith. We're remaking it. It was Vigilante, Georgia's Vote Suppression Hitman. Now it's going to be America's Vote Suppression Hitman, because we're taking this on the road to Arizona, North Carolina, Texas, Oklahoma, you name it, because this game, unfortunately, the tricks that they tried in Georgia and took for test drive in Georgia are now national. And so we'll be doing that. But you can get the film The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which will give you a lot of this story. Also, gregpalast.com. That's a free download.
So if I'm getting this straight, because in the movie, there were a couple of people, one woman who threatened you with a gun, yes. who challenged thousands of their neighbors, people they had no idea who they were, challenged their right to vote. That's coming to other states? That's going to maybe come to a state near us?
Well, yes. So what's happened is that they've expanded the right of individuals, that is vigilantes, to challenge someone else's vote. This GOP operative, and I want to remind you that she was a vice chair of the Republican Party in Georgia. 88 GOP operatives challenged 250,000 voters. This one woman challenged 36,000 voters. One woman. She couldn't even print out the name. She challenged somebody. She just handed it in a hard drive, said, don't let these people vote. We were able to, by the way, through the film and our actions in coordination with the voting groups like Black Voters Matter, we got that whole challenge blocked. We blocked almost every one of those challenges. But the law says anyone could challenge, and people don't know they've been challenged, and then it's too late. So luckily through our action, but the problem is Georgia's bringing it back, making it harder for us to challenge the challenges, and they're spreading it to other states. Texas is going big time. And this is being led by groups like True the Vote.
So bad policy coming to states across. And look, am I surprised by this? No, because that's the only way they can seem to win elections is by ensuring that the people don't actually vote. And then what I love, and this is, you know, masterful on their part, they then claim that when they don't win, everything's been stolen and rigged. And they've got a megaphone that's so large and powerful that's the message that gets taken. And we've got a corporate-controlled media who seems to be either laying down on the job or complicit. I don't know which, which is why, again, we don't hear these stories like the ones you're breaking.
Well, that is a problem. I mean, I was, you know, remember, most of my stories came out of Europe. I was with BBC Television and The Guardian. And almost all the vote suppression stories I did are all over Europe, all over the world. But in the U.S., it's very, very hard to get them into the mainstream, even when I've put it in places like Rolling Stone or Harper's. But God forbid the New York Times or Washington Post should pick this up. You know, they'll pick up once in a while, like they picked up when the ACLU, Black Voters Matter Fund, sued. Then they don't have to investigate. It's a lazy way of reporting. They just say, Black Voters Matter Fund and NAACP have sued the state of Georgia saying illegal voter removal. State of Georgia says, no, that's not true. He said, she said, good night.
Yeah.
But, you know, they are, you know, you have what I call lazy F-ism in American journalism. They don't want to do the work. It's not easy. It takes months to do this work. It takes a lot of money to do this work. And, you know, they're not going to do that. Plus, what do they get out of it? You know, so it's much easier to cover the Trump follies and say, oh, Trump tells us the lie that the votes were stolen. But then they use that to smear the Republicans, say, oh, well, Trump is lying, just like this is the Secretary of State of Georgia, the Republican Secretary of State. He says, well, Trump is making up this story that the votes are stolen in Georgia. But so is Stacey Abrams. So are the Democrats. They're claiming that the election was stolen from her. No, we're not claiming. We proved it. with the numbers, exactly, with the names of voters. I literally have the list of the names of voters illegally removed. I have many of them on film, sometimes in tears, sometimes in frustration. But that's the evidence. Don't look for it in your lamestream paper.
There you go. Greg, I got to get your thoughts on this as well. I mean, the Supreme Court just shot down affirmative action at universities because, heaven forbid, qualified people get, you know, an equal shot in this. But I saw a New York Times story that, because one of the things they didn't go after was legacy people. George W. Bush couldn't get into the University of Texas, but Harvard and Yale, yeah, why not? And they had a piece today on the, you know, on the study of elite college admissions. And they said that, you know, being rich is its own qualification. Are we surprised by that?
No. In fact, I would like, now this is a good reason to go to gregpalace.com. I want you to read my story, Confessions of an Affirmative Action Baby. When I was young, and I grew up in the anus of Los Angeles, Pacoima, mostly Hispanic neighborhood, and we were designated losers. Our job was to go to Vietnam. There was a test given to kids at Beverly Hills High and University High, the rich kids, that would allow them to get into UCLA early. I found out about it, demanded to take the test, aced it, but there was one problem. I flunked basic English because I grew up in a place, and they called my principal. I said, this guy has these high numbers, but he can't speak basic English. Now, normally that would prohibit you from going to the University of California, but they ignored it. They said, we're going to give this. The principal said, it's lucky he speaks English at all from our school. And so they gave me a break. This is affirmative action. And I ended up getting into there and you know, Stanford and Columbia, Chicago, et cetera. But, and then now, yes, I couldn't speak basic English. So it's supposed to be fair. But they gave me a break because I was not taught basic English. Let me tell you something. When this decision on affirmative action is not as horrible as it seems, because the real issue is, again, class. 43% of the non-white non-Asian admissions to Harvard, the so-called affirmative action students, 43% of them come from families with incomes well over $100,000. The legacy, if you are in the top 0.1%. In other words, not the top 1%, but the top 0.1%, one out of 1,000 richest families, your chance of getting into big schools like Harvard or Stanford is 2.2 times higher than if your income is average. So, and that has nothing to do with being a legatee or anything. They literally are looking for people who are super rich to let their kids in with the idea, yep, that, well, maybe they'll get some donation. So being super rich is a number one qualification or an elite school, whether your daddy went there or not. And then you get to the legacies. I mean, I'm sorry. Sasha Obama does not need to have a, should not be counted as an affirmative action choice by a big university. So what's happened is, but it was pointed out by the people who sued and said end racial affirmative action, because racial affirmative action had been a cover for letting in elites of a darker skin. And that's how it's been used overwhelmingly. They said, well, you could, if Harvard is really serious about bringing in black people, we did a calculation that if you eliminated the legacy admissions, and legacy admissions by that means your daddy went to Harvard or your grandpa went to Harvard. George Bush giggles about how he was a C student and got into Yale, forgetting, you know, not failing or failing to mention that his grandfather was on the board of trustees of Yale when he was admitted to Yale.
Yeah.
And he was a C student. So it's about class. They can completely racially integrate these elite schools if they eliminate the legacy and additional bonuses for simply being morbidly rich. You could literally, you won't need any affirmative action if you eliminate the affirmative action for the uber rich.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I found interesting the day the ruling came out. I said, you know, look, you know, legacy, the moneyed folks, the people who have the elites, they're well taken care of. Everybody else, not so much. The website, gregpalast.com. You can find all the great stuff there of his investigative journalism, his best-selling books, and also his movies there for view. And I can't wait for the new one, Greg. When it comes out, I'd love to have it. We'll do an event together.
You bet we will. So, yeah, but Best Democracy Money Can Buy will be available on the site now for free.
There you go. GregPalast.com. Thanks so much, Greg. Appreciate the time. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Again, gregpalast.com. Make sure you check it out. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1968. That was the first day of a new U.S. labor partnership, the Alliance for Labor Action. The alliance was forged by the president of the United Auto Workers, Walter Reuther, and the president of the Teamsters Union, Frank Fitzsimmons. The UAW had left the AFL-CIO over differences on how to approach labor organizing. The newly formed alliance with the Teamsters stood as a progressive alternative to the AFL-CIO's approach at the time. The ALA called for forming community unions for the millions of poor and unorganized workers. It supported the civil rights movement, as well as the movement against the war in Vietnam. One of the ALA's slogans was, quote, to find answers to the urgent problems of our society. The ALA developed position papers on a series of issues. One of those urgent problems was health care. The ALA described, quote, the United States is the last remaining industrialized country in the world which does not have a national health insurance plan which would assure all its citizens at least minimum guarantee of access to needed medical care. In 1969, the ALA launched its first major organizing drive in Atlanta, Georgia. The drive targeted multiple industries and included a massive advertising campaign. But the Atlanta business community stood in staunch opposition to the unionization effort. Despite some successes, the Atlanta effort did not garner the hoped-for results. The ALA suffered another blow when Walter Reuther died in a plane crash in May of 1970. The alliance disbanded in 1972. Universal health care and many of the other causes championed by the ALA remain unrealized.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Rube Goldberg would marvel at Senator Joe Manchin's wacky, convoluted machinations to rig the system so fossil fuel polluters can run roughshod over nature, local people, and democracy. Goldberg was a master of satirical cartoons, drawing hilarious schematics of convoluted contraptions to do silly tasks. His self-operating napkin, for example, involved a cracker, toucan, skyrocket, sickle, and a pendulum attached to a napkin, all operating sequentially to wipe the chin of a soup eater. So here comes Joe with his own sequential machinations to zip, ping, spring, push his pet corporate boondoggle into law. Manchin's Mountain Valley Pipeline would ram a 300-mile polluting pipe through the pristine mountains of West Virginia into Virginia and North Carolina, ripping through farms, communities, national parks, and 1,000 streams and waterlands. The people hated it, and amazingly, environmental regulators and multiple courts sided with the people again and again. Time for Joe's Rube Goldberg Act. Late last year, ping! Manchin switched from a no on a climate change bill to a yes in exchange for President Biden supporting the pipeline. But congressional progressives rebelled, so their dirty deal failed. Then, spring, Biden snuck Manchin's boondoggle into this year's must-pass debt ceiling bill, so whoosh, locals and environmentalists were blown away. Wait, though, the federal court that had been siding with the people still had a say. But zzzt. Manchin and Biden teamed up with congressional Republicans to shift jurisdiction over the pipeline from that court to one with corporate-friendly judges. But the abandoned court says, hold it, Congress is unconstitutionally interfering in the judicial branch's power. This is Jim Hightower saying, so do Manchin and Biden get to stiff the people? Undecided, but they've already revealed to the people how corrupt their Rube Goldberg system is.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
And I got to tell you, it's interesting to me to see how across the country, states doing really well, from Pennsylvania, Alabama, Washington, all across the country. 17 states have seen their jobless rates record lows. And, you know, the thing that's interesting is you've got a lot of these red states, you know, places like South Dakota that has 1.8% unemployment. We're talking a major boom, major investments going into these places. And it's got to be a little awkward for these red state politicians who, you know, are saying, look how wonderful the economy is, and then trying to bash Biden for the economy. It's just kind of difficult. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, our good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick.
So what do you think of this? I mean, the economy's doing well in a lot of places. You've got unemployment at record lows in a lot of places. And yet I listen to my conservative friends and it's all about, you know, we're going to hit a recession tomorrow. It's all doomsday because they need it to be.
Well, the recession went, as some experts predicted, not a recession. It took a bump and a hump and this and that, but didn't turn into what, you know, everybody was expecting to happen, especially after 2 years of COVID and the supply chain and inflation, you know, on and on. Now, the big deal, and as you mentioned, it's in a lot of red states, but the manufacturing boom, and it has, you know, obviously created, according to the statistics, 800,000 some manufacturing jobs nationwide, which is the area what, you know, we need to accomplish, what we need to do. You know, Trump was real big on manufacturing 2016, and, you know, that helped him in some states. And this is actually producing, you know, a lot of jobs. And, you know, Biden is taking credit, of course, for those jobs. But the Republicans, you know, are constantly, you know, hammering him about the economy. And so part of the problem, I think, that the Democratic side is going to have to deal with and, you know, grab a hold of and continue to, you know, to point out, of course, you know, Republicans voted against most of the president's proposals, and they're going to have to keep that message out there because, you know, still sometimes in the polling, the president is not getting people aboard as he should. So it's messaging.
No, it's completely messaging.
They can do it in a lot of ways.
No, you're spot on. And, you know, what also is happening, we talked a little bit earlier with Don Wiener from the Center for Media and Democracy. He's pointing out that in a number of red states, start expecting this ALEC legislation that's going to start hitting to preempt union organizing in a lot of these places. You know, Ford went into Tennessee, is going into Tennessee, and Ford has a neutrality agreement with the UAW, and Tennessee lost their mind that how dare those jobs be union jobs that are going to pay good wages. So they're saying, look, they passed a law, any state subsidies that go to any of these places, you got to go and bust those unions. And we're expecting ALEC to push that across the country. Again, keeping wages down, keeping the kind of growth that could happen, you know, stymied. That seems to be the plan.
Well, it is. And ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, doesn't do this by accident.
Nope.
You know, there are think tank people, money, et cetera, you know, behind this. We had this push at one point in time in Ohio when I was there. It was the ABC, it was called, American Building Conference and the Council. And they would coordinate and, you know, these people would support ALEC and then they would try to get this legislation going as much as possible in as many, you know, states as possible. Now, For example, the transportation bill when Bush was president, Andy Card had a fit. That was the chief of staff. He wanted, the federal tinkering, I call it, which would have been completely destructive for jobs and the trades. He wanted that undone in the federal transportation bills. He wasn't successful. So, there are people out there that have done and will continue to do this type of thing, which will erode the working wages, and then they'll complain. The same people, Rick, will complain about, look at the wages under Biden. They're not there.
No, I mean, it's amazing that these groups never seem to run out of bad ideas. I mean, they pay people a lot of money to think up how to harm working people, and this is the next iteration of that. Passing the No Rights at Work agenda, that wasn't enough. Now going to force employers. I mean, this is remarkable to me. If you want tax subsidies, if you want help in building your facilities and education and any of that stuff, you have to harass and intimidate your workers. You have to threaten to fire them. You have to coerce them. You have to do all that stuff. You can't just say, I'll be neutral and you decide. No, you got to fight, which is, it's twisted to me.
Well, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's just like, none of the local governments say, we're going to have, some development monies here. We're going to build an industrial park, and you must come in union. They don't say that.
No.
It's up to the union to, get the organization going. But if you reverse this, these groups want it to actually be said that you can't be. You have to do this. You have to do that.
It's amazing.
It's not even a fair shake for union organizing. So it's again, it's planned. It's not by accident.
Nope, none of this stuff is. Got to get some of your thoughts on some other stories I ran across. The dumbest guy in the U.S. Senate still holding up nearly 300 senior military promotions. I guess we still don't have a commandant for the Marine Corps. Is that accurate?
That's correct. When you just said that, my mind flashed when you said the dumbest guy. I was trying to debate out of three or four people. Now I know who you're talking about. Well, we don't. After, how many years? 100 and some years. And we don't have it. And, of course, he went after used the House to go after the defense authorization bill, which is, not going to cut it in the Senate. But he's got that power to hold up appointments, and that's what he's done with the commandant.
Yeah, now you've got a number of Democrats who have sent a letter to Mitch McConnell saying, hey, can you deal with the dumbest guy in the Senate? Maybe give him a lollipop or something?
Right. Well, that's the other thing about the Senate I just could never stand. Any senator, now it used to be done in secret, usually it leaks out, but any senator can put holds on, one senator can put a hold on something.
Or as I say, it's the place where progress goes to die.
It's true.
And there it is. I got to get your thought on the fake electors. Mm-hmm. Look at Michigan and Dana Nessel, who we interviewed on our Working Class Heroes radio tour, and she's fantastic. Charged these 16 people in the fake elector scheme. My favorite story of the day. Today, one of the women, she says she was duped into it. She didn't want to do it. She was duped into it. In fact, I think she said that they actually took her name off of an index card and did it that way, forged her name. I guess that's the argument.
Well, you and I talked about this last week on your show when the article came out about it was about 6 days or so ago. We talked about this. And I remember we were talking also about the fact that, you're going to start to hear things because when these profiles in courage get caught, then they're going to start to, I didn't know, or he made me do it.
He made me do
which
it.
Doesn't absolve them from their sin. But a lot of stuff's going to come out.
Yeah.
So this is not going to be the only state to do this. A lot of stuff is going to come out.
The rats
and
will start jumping ship.
And then they're going to connect dots for the whole thing.
Yeah. No, I mean, the rats are going to start jumping ship, and it's going to be interesting, which is why I think you got Mitt Romney out there, urging the GOP to, hey, can we find somebody else, anyone? Republicans are going to lose, and I think he knows that. But, it's the base, man.
Well, look at Laura Ingraham, who on her show said, you know, right out front, will you please stop talking about the last election? She said that to Trump. They know that this, you know, constant referral to the last election is obviously also stepping on any message that the Republicans want to get out there. I would hate to be running for Congress today trying to get around the noise to get your message out.
No, I mean, Trump's a major disruptor. And the thing is you know, who are the Republicans going to get behind? DeSantis? Have you looked at the mess of his campaign? I guess over the weekend he was with a bunch of donors saying, well, we're gonna shake things up. We're going to do better.
DeSantis did, and you know this, you know grassroots politics better than anybody I know. What happened to DeSantis? After, of course, he had the amazing ad that he had, which was, I don't know what I thought that ad was, but he had that ad, and then on top of everything, what's he do the next week? Fires the campaign manager, redoes the decks on the Titanic on his campaign. Anytime you see that happening, then you know they're in trouble. There were calls at one point in time, remember, for Karl Rove to go, and Bush was smart. He said, no, I'm not going to do that. Because once you start down that road, then your campaign is in a chaotic mess, and that's what has happened to DeSantis. Plus, he has to understand something. What worked in Florida for him, drag shows and Disney World and et cetera, it's not, I don't know, but maybe I'm, you know, old-fashioned, but I don't hear that here in Ohio. Yeah. Well, we need to make him president so he can do something about Disney World and the drag queens. Let's put him in. I don't hear that here.
Yeah, well, there is that. But then the other choice, Mike Pence. And I love the fact that, you know, he was on CNN with Dana Bash, and he claimed that he wasn't worried about Trump's rhetoric. And she's like, that's pretty remarkable that you're not concerned about it, given the fact that they wanted to hang you on January 6th. I think that is the greatest response. Because for me, for with Mike Pence, every question would start with, you know, so when they wanted to hang you, and then whatever the question was. But, you know, that has to be front and center. And he's never really addressed that.
No. Well, and let's look at, you know, Ted Cruz. His father tried to kill President Kennedy. His wife was disgusting looking. And he ended up supporting Trump. I mean, I'm just thinking, how far do you have to go? Did Trump have to actually try to put the noose around Pence before he would say something? How far do you have to go?
Exactly.
I don't get it.
You brought up the Ted Cruz thing, and my wife laughed when you said that, you know, Trump made fun of his wife, called her ugly. He did. And I've said a number of times, had he said that to me in that space, we'd be rolling around on the ground.
Sure, absolutely. And it would be okay to grab him and roll him around on the ground over it. I don't get it. And Pence, of course, you know, Pence is like watching paint dry, and he's not going to get anywhere.
So who is the Republican alternative? Do you think that, I mean, because there's you know, Vivek Ramaswamy, you got Nikki Haley, you got a whole bunch of people, Youngkin, they're courting. You know, who do you think, if it's not going to be Trump, where do you think they end up going?
Well, I just don't see DeSantis as, you know, he might be the, quote, most conservative, but he's not even getting traction in circles. So I would assume they've got to go with Nikki Haley or Chris Christie. I know he had the bridge thing, but, you know, politicians have their scandals in return. But if I'm looking at the candidates, I mean, it's not going to be Pence.
No,
Pence, you know, was marked by Trump. And so I think Haley or Chris Christie, Vivek Ramaswamy, I just don't, they might take him as a VP choice, but I just think at this point in time, it's got to be Christie or Nikki Haley, unless they pull somebody else out.
Yeah, I don't see Christie. I just don't see the base. I fear him, but I just don't see the base.
Well, here's the thing, too. about the base that, you know, we don't know. If it's not Trump, do they sit there and say, well, I'm angry and, you know, I'll just let Joe Biden serve another term? I don't think they will, but there won't be the same obvious excitement. That's why I still say Nikki Haley.
Yeah.
She doesn't seem to have suffered what Pence and Christie and even DeSantis have. Of course, yeah. DeSantis is getting it because of Trump himself.
No, it'll be interesting. It'd be interesting to see if you know, because I had someone tell me the other day they don't think Biden's gonna make it to the nomination or to the election. So it'd be interesting to see a Kamala Harris, Nikki Haley, you know, lineup. Which you know, I don't even want to get into what I think would happen there.
I am not taking that bait on your show either.
I slow rolled that one out. That was an easy one for you. It's an easy grounder.
I'm having my mind go somewhere else. And what other Republican candidates are out there? So, yeah.
Okay. And finally, I wanted to get your thoughts on, I had a listener, you know, tell me that the Obamas murdered their chef.
Oh.
Is that what we're going to hear tomorrow?
I mean, you know, what I would say to the right, you know, do they think his food was that bad, really, that they can actually try to pin this? There was one, wasn't a mainstream, but I did actually see somebody, you know, put out, well, this is sort of like the Clintons, you know, all the people that were around the Clintons that, yeah, quote, died as a result. This is sort of like the Clintons. They weren't there. He had an accident. And they tried this. I wish I could remember this site. They tried to twist it about, you know, how he died, and somebody was seen pulling his body out, which was already dead before he got into water, which I want to say, how do they know that since there's been no coroner report?
See, the Obamas not being there, that's their move. That's how they do it. That's how they kill people. They're not there.
Right, right. Now, I did see that on one site, though, that they knew that he was already deceased when they pulled him out of the water. That was their statement. He was deceased when they pulled him out of the water.
Yeah, because he drowned. That's what happens when, mm-hmm, you drown.
Right.
Oh, wow. Well, we'll see. We'll see how this plays out. But as always, Bob, I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Rick.
Always good stuff. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind? Love to hear it. Also, remember, check out the podcast. Never miss a moment. Take the show on the go. Quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1877. Workers organized the first general strike in American history. The strike was an outgrowth of the railroad strike, which you may know if you're a regular listener of Labor History in 2, that started 10 days earlier in Martinsburg, West Virginia. The drastic wage cuts demanded by competing railroad magnates brought about a work stoppage in East St. Louis on July 22nd. Railroad workers voted to go on strike, shutting down all freight traffic. The strike quickly spread across the river to St. Louis, which at the time was the nation's third largest manufacturing city. The St. Louis strike was led by the Socialist Working Man's Party. The Working Man's Party called for a mass meeting at Lucas Market that gathered an enormous crowd of thousands of workers to declare their strike. The St. Louis strikers set out clear goals of ending child labor and establishing an 8-hour workday. By the next day, the strike had almost completely shut the city down. The strike lasted nearly a week. However, divisions between rank and file and strike leadership emerged over issues of race. The demonstrations that emerged in the afternoon of the 25th were led by a group of Black River workers. In an interview following the strike, an executive committee member said, "We did all we could to get the crowd to disperse." He wanted to keep white strikers from following the lead of Black workers. The city's upper classes, startled by the events, began organizing a militia to quell the strike.
Finally, federal troops arrived in St. Louis to crush the uprising. Special deputized police joined their forces. They arrested the strike leaders, injured hundreds, and killed at least 18 people. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. I want to get to a couple of quick emails before we wrap up. See, Lewis sent me an email. Said he thought I handled the call with CJ wonderfully. Look, I was having a conversation. He said the problem I have with CJ's logic is very individualistic. He says, quote, why should I pay for paternity leave when I don't plan to have any kids? Simple answer is, even though he may not need it, someone else will, and what he pays a portion is to be used by the insurance company to cover paternity care for those who do. It's the idea that us folks who believe in community and the idea of being a brother's keeper and all that stuff, it plays into it. And basic insurance, that's the other part. Lewis goes on to say it's the same dribble I hear from some of my neighbors who complain about having to pay taxes that fund our public schools when their kids have graduated a long time ago. My response is you do have an interest because the better schools, the better the property values of the homes in the district, meaning the asset they own grows in value. Geez, whatever happened to the notion of the common good and value in community? And this is where we've been sold this from Reagan forward. Hooray for me and the heck with everyone else. My problem again with this idea of piecemeal insurance is that somebody is going to make a mistake. I don't need cancer care. Well, what happens when you get cancer? The taxpayer picks this up. The problem with health insurance, and I've had this conversation 1,000 times, is that we as taxpayers pay for the most costly people, which are our children, first 5 years, last 5 years of life, seniors. The idea that we're going to take the most expensive portion of caring for society out of the insurance pool. And we're going to say we're going to fund that with tax dollars is remarkable to me. I'm simply a believer in one giant pool. Everybody in. One pool. That's it. Everybody. Anyone who knows anything about actuarial tables and basic insurance knows that the larger the pool, the smaller the risk. And look, I'm not opposed to the idea of health savings accounts as an extra, but not as a way that we have a public policy, because some people are going to be luckier than others. Some people are going to end up having, much more costly. We had a caller earlier said, a couple of days in the hospital was, $400,000. That money, that finite amount that you have in your health savings account evaporates pretty quickly in that environment. And what happens if you're sick young? And you don't get to build those years. There's a lot of, it's not a workable solution for when you're talking about everybody. I'm not against, a portion going in that direction. I'm actually kind of in favor of the idea. I think it was the Heritage Foundation or the Inter-American Enterprise Institute or one of them who came out and said, every baby that's born, the government should put $10,000 into an account and just leave it there. I'm not opposed to that idea. I don't know where the money would come from. I need it neither. But the idea of allowing that throughout a lifetime to build would build wealth. That is it. That's not a bad idea. It's what rich people do. Wouldn't be a bad idea for working people. But on the healthcare front, this idea of, I keep having people tell me we're a Christian nation, but we don't bother that heal the sick, take care of our neighbor thing very much. So yeah, when I hear people say, I only want what I want, that's selfish. But that's what, 40 years of Reaganomics have gotten us. That's what hooray for me and the heck with society gets us. That's what, the greed is good. The one who dies with the most toys wins. That's where that comes from. And it's what is spewed in right-wing circles. Why should I have to pay for those women having children? Because we want to have kids that are healthy. That we need, to help the next generation, that we will, maybe that next generation of kids that are going to grow up to be doctors that'll take care of you, even though you didn't have kids.
you know, maybe the person who's going to, you know, I don't know, the arguments the right makes to me about being against abortion. Maybe that kid's going to cure cancer. But it never seems to work. It's always hooray for me. So I appreciate the email, Lewis. It's, again, I wish we could come back to that idea of the common good, of you know, taking care of our neighbors. You know, kind of like what Jason Aldean says his song is about, without it actually being about that. Just interesting times that we live in. But I want to hear your thoughts. Is there something that I said got under your skin, on your nerves? By all means, I want to hear it. Or do you have a healthcare story? I mean, at the end of the day, we've all got them. How should we fix our healthcare situation? What would be the best way? I think one giant insurance pool. I want to hear yours. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion.